The Riddles This World Made for Me. Written by Electro Peach. Narrated by Rhea314. Fandom: 9 Worlds Series by Victoria Goddard. The Lays of the Hearthfire Series by Victoria Goddard. The Red Company Series by Victoria Goddard. Relationship: Artoran Damara, aka Fitzroy Angersell, / Cleofer Kip Ndong. Chapter 1. There I saw and adored how the earth all around me was blooming. I had found my own ground in a world that had whirled all around me.
Will this do?
Fitzroy, it's a fern. I looked down at the plant. It was green and long and sort of leafy, and apparently a fern, which seemed to make it not appropriate for one of the 7 different flowers. I had wondered if it was a sort of lettuce. Not for the first time, I wished my tower had come with more books on plants. I had never known there were so many types of trees and flowers and bushes and reeds and plants. That was not entirely true. I had, I think, known this once. I had vague memories of trotting after someone in a large garden, stopping to examine plant after plant, to sketch them and write down descriptions of them according to that someone's instructions. It felt so much like a daydream that I had often wondered if it was something I had read in a book rather than something I had done before coming to my tower. They said to look out for ferns. I defended myself, as though I had recognized the plant as a fern and picked it up on purpose. Tulinar laughed. Yes, for a mythical flowering one. She gave my fern a gentle flick of her finger. I see no flower, and you, my friend, are sufficiently magical as you are. I peered down at the green plant in my hand with a doubtful frown. It did not look at all poised to spout mythical flowers, although, in truth, I had no clear idea what a mythical flower would look like. I don't see any buds, I remarked, faintly pleased with myself for this piece of obscure flower lore. Flowers slept in buds, I knew from my extensive study of poetry. I wondered what they looked like when they slept, and immediately wanted to find one to pry a bud open and peer in. But then it occurred to me that they might wrinkle in annoyance, the way Polly did, if I opened the curtains too early, and regretfully I abandoned the plan as potentially impolite. My friend, a friend of my very own, still such a delightful concept, grinned at me. I turned my attention from the disappointing greenery to the spellbinding charm of her freckles and single merry dimple that appeared on the right side of her face when she smiled just so. It's not a flowering plant, she explained. That's why the folks here say it brings one magical powers to find a flowering fern on a midsummer night. I tilted my head to examine the fern again. It did not look magical in the least, but then it was not flowering. And on the other hand, these were strange new flowers and strange new lands for all of us. We were on Isthar, certainly. The faint scent of the magic in the air clearly of the Empire. But there was an unfamiliar sort of echoing to it that made the Empire of Astandalos feel very distant. I suspected that the last portal had tumbled us out in a different time as well as a different world, which was not supposed to happen, but of course one was also not supposed to use the portals one found in the borderlands. Chulinar was looking at me with that smile on her face again, the one that crinkled the corners of her eyes prettily and brought out the dimple. Here, look at mine, she offered, and let me examine the bundle of flowers clutched in her hand. Polly had merely raised a brow when Julinar and I had expressed a desire to participate in any and all midsummer traditions with our hosts, up to and including the various superstitions and spells revolving around it. She had opted out of everything else, but agreed to weave, and even wear, a crown of flowers with the rest of us, as well as to help the villagers prepare the great bonfire by the lake, while Julinar and I, and a slightly bemused Damien, had eagerly followed the young villagers to the surrounding meadows and forests to find and gather 7 different flowers and to participate in the search of a magical flowering fern. The 7 different flowers, I understood, were to be placed under our pillows that night for a glimpse of a future spouse in our dreams. To double our chances of seeing said spouses, we would also be walking backwards to the village well sometime after dinner. Julinar, I noticed, had already gathered a lovely, lush, cascading bundle of different flowers, all with green stems like my fern, but with flowers in white, pink, and beautiful purple. It matched her flower crown, and mine, which had been rescued from my attempts by one of the local girls, who had deemed my enthusiasm greater than my talents. Fortunately, the flowers in those had been picked earlier by some of the locals, or no doubt I would have been still wandering around trying to find something to weave into a crown. Damien, who had trailed after us in confusion but seemed to take pleasure in putting on his glasses and discovering the differences between this little white flower and that little white flower, wandered up to us, showing us his findings. Precisely 7 different flowers, all stacked neatly in his fist, and cut to the exact same length. I held my fern and a single wild rose, the one flower I had been able to identify at sight, thanks to its prevalence in the illustrations of my old copy of Tales from Isthar, as well as vague memories of once being disappointed that I could not set up a rose garden by a red house because it was on the wrong world. And I could not help but stare at my friend's bundles with envy. Julinar evidently saw my expression and took pity on me. "Come, I'll help you find the ones I have," she said encouragingly, and took my hand to lead me around the meadow, while Damien wandered back to one of the villagers to ask if his flowers would be sufficient for the task. I heard the girl titter nervously as she assured him that they were perfectly fine. I exchanged a grin with Julinar. Our handsome, serious friend seemed to have that effect on local youths wherever we went. Together we made short work of gathering the remaining 6 different flowers from my bundle. Insatiably curious as always, and feeling strangely driven to be prepared to hand in a list of every plant I had ever seen on my adventure, I wanted to know all their names. Julinar told me that she was not familiar with the local flowers, and then immediately proceeded to demonstrate that she could name most of them anyway. In addition to the rose, I was apparently holding meadow buttercups. Although the whereabouts of the promised butter as well as the cup remained a mystery to me. Lupin, with little pods and fetching pinks and purples, some sort of spotted orchid, crane's bills, which derailed us for a moment because I had never realized that cranes would drop their bills like lizards dropped their tails, nor that the bills would then turn into flowers. Julinar seemed so surprised by my exclamation that it seemed she had not realized this either. And 2 other flowers she could not name. "Although that one looks a bit like Lily of the Valley," she mused, pointing out the one with the pretty little bell-like flowers. "Which would make it toxic, so don't put it in your mouth." She gave me a considering look. "In fact, as a rule, I would prefer it if you didn't put anything in your mouth that you just picked up in a forest." "Like a poison apple," I agreed earnestly. Julinar dimpled at me in that peculiar way she did when she smiled and tried to press her lips together all at once, as if holding back a sneeze or a giggle. Her shoulders were shaking, and she had to push her flower crown back up when it fell over her right eye because of this. "Like a poison apple," she managed to confirm, in a perfectly solemn voice. Our flowers safely deposited under our pillows for the night, we went out to partake in the feast and admire and enjoy the bonfire. Polly was eyeing the fire with the satisfied proprietary eye of one who had, according to her own words, built most of it. Seated on a log, looking incongruous in her warrior's robes, her sheathed sword beside her, and her delicate crown of flowers slightly askew on her dark hair, she graciously accepted our praise, as well as the villagers' open admiration. There was singing, drinking, and dancing around the fire. Julinar and Damien's pale cheeks flushed in the glow of the fire. One of the locals draped an arm around me and excitedly told me so many stories of their midsummer traditions that I could not remember half of them later. A village elder showed me how to play the local instrument, a sort of five-stringed harp held vertically in his lap, and I played my harp for them, to general appreciation. The sky was still a pale blue. The sun would not set at all tonight, we were told. When the elderly and the very young crawled to their beds, leaving the others to continue the celebrations. The locals took turns in a large communal sauna, which Damien and I also tried and had to abandon in short order to the merry laughter of the locals. I had not imagined fire and hot air could ever make me turn tail and run, but I had not anticipated the humidity. Mercifully, the lake was right there, the limpid water pleasantly cool and sweet on my heated skin. Damien was flushed red to the roots of his hair from the steam, and Julinar, sitting on the pier with Polly and a group of laughing maidens, her flower crown fetchingly lopsided, was delightfully pink with how different the local modesty standards were to what she was used to. Once we had recovered from our attempt at braving the sauna, a group of the unmarried villagers took us to the village well, where they each took turns, spinning each other around for a few rounds, aiming their friends so that the well was directly behind them, and walking backwards to the water, to turn at the last moment for a chance to glimpse their future spouse in the water. As the night was wearing on, and plenty of drinks had been enjoyed throughout the course of the meal and the celebrations, many of them spun out and stumbled into each other's arms, instead laughing and snickering. We, seasoned adventurers, were, of course, prepared to give them a better show. Polly went first, graceful and perfectly steady on her backward walk, and spun so fast from the well to sketch us a magnificent bow that I suspected she had not even glanced at the water. Briefly, I wondered if she had wanted to avoid risking even a glimpse of her future. But then Damien followed her, careful and precise, and peered at the water doubtfully for a moment before admitting that he could only see a vague dark shape, probably his own shadow. At this point, Julinar remembered that he was not wearing his glasses, which were in her pocket, and Damien assured her that it was on purpose, for he didn't want to drop them in the well. Julinar followed Damien, teetered a little on her backward walk, almost dropped her flower crown into the water, and examined her future in the well with a serious expression. "She looks familiar," she said solemnly. "Looks like we have the same taste in hair, clothes, and even freckles. One can hope we will also enjoy the same books and have plenty to talk about." While people were still laughing at her description of her reflection, I hastened to follow her. Polly's dark eyes twinkled at me. Oh, perhaps I would even see her. As she and a local young man gripped my arms and spun me around, set my back to the well, and bade me walk. I made an honest attempt, but my feet wanted to go sideways rather than backwards, and I ended up sailing from side to side to a great deal of laughter and clapping. Pleased with the attention, if not perfect success, I paused in front of the well to deliver a courtly bow that nearly landed my crown of flowers in the sand, and had some of our hosts howling with laughter. Adjusting my crown, I straightened with rather more vigor than I had planned, caught my heel on a pebble, and toppled backwards into the well. I had just enough time to hear Julinar's alarmed yelp before I was submerged. Barely a bewildered moment had passed, however, before strong hands reached in to grasp me and pulled me out of the water. The hands lifted me, spluttering and coughing, by the back of my tunic and dragged me halfway out of the water, not onto packed dirt, but warm, even stone, and there was a low, calm voice in my ears. "Easy now. Cough it out. You're safe," the voice was saying, smooth and reassuring, in an unfamiliar accent with a pleasant twang. I did as I was asked and coughed, sprawled on the oddly warm stones, until I could draw breath and lift my head to blink at my surroundings. Not a village by the lake on a nightless night in the far north, certainly, but a full sunlit day in, well, where indeed? The water in my mouth tasted salty, but it had definitely been a drinking well I had fallen into. "There," the voice said, faintly amused. A large, warm hand rested on my back, comforting through the wet fabric of my tunic.
"What were you doing in my backyard pool, then, Sayo?"
"Engersel," I declared. Which promptly set me coughing again, which in turn knocked my flower crown, still miraculously on my head, over my eyes, and prevented me from seeing the man's face. I was very proud of the name. It was brand new, much newer than Fitzroy, and I had wanted it ever since Julinar had pointed out that most people had a last name, too. A startled silence followed my announcement, broken a moment later by a low chuckle.
"So you are," the man said,
his voice soft with some emotion I could not identify. And I looked up to see an old man with lovely tea-colored eyes regarding me with such fondness that it caught me off guard. He looked magnificent. Not quite like any old person I had ever seen before. And I had seen at least 3 old people this close before, and at least 30 from afar. And he didn't look like any of them at all. He stood there with his broad shoulders and bare chest gleaming in the sun, barefoot and unarmed, and yet with the same sort of poise and quiet grace and strength as Damien or Polly did. I could not decide what I wanted to admire first. The pretty feathers, threaded in his dark, silver-streaked hair, or the beautifully dyed sarong he was wearing, or the shining, glittering pearls and shells around his neck. I settled on blinking up at all of him in admiration. He reached out a hand, wide and strong and unadorned but for a single golden ring that seemed incongruous among his nature-inspired regalia, and I took it and let him pull me to my feet, which turned out to be a little wobbly. The after effects of the sauna, no doubt. Or possibly the unintended intermundial travel, I mused, because I had definitely tripped from one world to another again. The air tasted of salt and sand and a whole host of floral scents I had never encountered before, and around us was a lovely little courtyard enclosed by 2 large houses in a style and color wholly unfamiliar to me. And the man before me stood cloaked in legends and swirling magic like he had just stepped out of some ancient poem. It was enough to make any young spellcaster a little unsteady on his feet, to be honest. I straightened my dripping flower crown self-consciously.
"Very well, Sayo Engersel," the man said,
his eyes dancing with a mischievous sort of delight, even as his mouth did that thing Julinar's did when she was trying to decide if something I said was about to make her laugh or tear up.
"Would you be inclined to share what you were doing in my pool?"
"I really have no idea, sir," I assured him. This did not seem quite sufficient, particularly in the face of that magnificently questioning raised brow. I was definitely going to learn how to do that. So I went on, politely. "Only that I did not quite mean to be in your pool." The man looked like he was biting his lip to keep some great emotion from emerging, and muttered something that sounded like, "Not surprising." And, "So young." This seemed a little excessive. I was almost 19 and a seasoned adventurer, after all. "I think I must have accidentally fallen into a portal between worlds," I said, to demonstrate that I was, in fact, very well-traveled and experienced. "Surely your pool must get intermundial visitors all the time, since it's a portal." The man glanced, for some reason, up at the highest point of one of the houses curving around the courtyard. I squinted against the sun to see what looked like a tower room, with windows thrown open to the sea breeze and the sun.
"No," he said slowly. "I sometimes hear a particular Alanoral inn when I open the door to the pantry, and I'm half convinced there's another portal as well as a hidden staircase somewhere in the house. But no surprise visitors from the pool so far. My resident mage has neglected to mention that there is a portal in the pool as well."
"You're not a mage yourself." He looked amused at my surprise.
"Most assuredly not."
"Are you sure? You're wearing a lot of magic." I peered at him curiously and tilted my head.
Something about the swirling eddies of magic weaving around the man's person and soul tugged at a responding something deep within me. Some of it feels almost familiar, like something I've read about. I shook myself out of my daze and turned a bright smile at the man. He looked faintly bemused, as though a little uncertain of what to say to that. "Very well," he agreed, choosing to ignore my remarks on the magic dancing around him. "If you did not intend to emerge from my pool, what did you intend? What were you looking for when you, fell into a different world?" A simple enough question. "Looking for my future spouse," I informed him brightly. The man, garbed in legends and oddly familiar magic, went very still. Belatedly perceiving how a statement like that might come across as awkward from a dashing young stranger who had just surfaced from your backyard pond, I hastened to add, "Oh, not here. I was supposed to only look in the water to see them, but I'm afraid I tripped and fell all the way in, and the next thing I knew, I was here, wherever here is." I looked around again. There were at least 7 different flowers in just the flower bed by the wall. I wondered if Julinar could name them, too, and shuffled closer to inspect a white one with a lovely, heady scent. My hands paused just before plucking it. "May I have one?" I remembered to ask. "Certainly," the man said, sounding no longer amused, but a little touched for some reason. "That one is called Tiare." "What a lovely name," I admired. "I shall have to put it in one of my poems." "Oh, would you?" the man asked, and for a moment he sounded so wistful and excited that I turned to look at him in surprise, the freshly picked flower in my hand. To my disappointment, by the time I turned around, the man was already clearing his throat and arranging his face to hide whatever he thought his expression would have revealed. "Zunir," he said, perfectly steadily. "You're on Zunid." I perked up, forgetting my brief excitement about the flowers. "Really? Have you seen a big red house around here?" I asked, momentarily elated, before remembering that the climate of my vague memories of the house that I had thought had been my home before the tower was quite different from this one. The magic-clad man looked very gentle, like he had caught my brief flare of excitement and consequent wilting. "Oh, many. Although not the one you're thinking of, I suspect." He paused, considering me with a soft, wistful look in his brown eyes. For a moment, he seemed to fight with himself, before clearly making up his mind about something. With a determined, almost defiant air, he allowed a radiant smile to spread on his face and steal all the way to his eyes, secret and conspiratorial and shining like we were breaking a rule together. "Don't worry, Fitzroy. There will be other houses to welcome you, red and otherwise." What a wonderful promise. I beamed at the man, surely a wizard of some sort, or god-touched in some way, to be able to pronounce my future so plainly with such confidence, and took 2 steps back to be able to sweep an imaginary hat off my head and give him my prettiest bow. "Thank you, kind sir," I exclaimed as I bowed low. "What a fortuitous meeting this has been." He had called me Fitzroy. My gaze snapped up at him, at the rueful little quirk of his lips that seemed to acknowledge that he had slipped up. Deliberately? And I straightened and opened my mouth to ask him about it, but, alas, I had taken a half step too far back for my bow, placing my weight on my heel as I stood up, sent me, once more, tipping backwards into the dark depths of the water. I had just enough time to see the radiant stranger's expression flit through alarm, amusement, and exasperation, before I was submerged once more, this time to be hauled up by my friends and the concerned and annoyed villagers. After recovering from my plunge, I cast a blessing upon the well to purify it, and to make up for falling into the villagers' drinking water, and spent the rest of the celebrations obediently by the bonfire to dry up. My spirits were soon lifted again by the merriment around me, but my mind was still working on the mystery of my adventure when Julinar and I finally crawled under our blankets between the already sleeping Damien and Polly. "What is that?" Julinar asked, as I shuffled around to remove the one flower she had not been able to name from under my pillow and replace it with the new one from Zunid. "A tiara," I reminded myself, trying to imprint the word in my memory for some future song. What a pretty name. Like a tiara to be worn on your head. Perhaps tomorrow Julinar would help me secure it to my crown of flowers. "A souvenir," I informed her loftily. "From a different world." She burst out laughing and did not ask me to clarify, which I supposed was an indication of how often something like this had happened to me, even in our brief acquaintance. When I turned to look at her, feeling slightly abashed, she was grinning at me. "I should have clarified that you only needed to look into the water, not fall all the way in and try to physically find your future spouse." "Well, I didn't," I retorted, but then felt compelled to add thoughtfully, "Although I do think I met a folk hero, or a minor deity." "Only you," Julinar muttered to herself and shook her head. "Well, perhaps we will have better luck with the flowers." "Perhaps. Sleep well, Julinar." "Sweet dreams, Fitzroy." Alas, my dreams that night were entirely devoid of merry maidens or handsome men, or other potential future spouses. But I did dream of a plan to reform the post in astonishing detail. Perhaps I considered sleepily as I roused enough to turn, curling up with my face to Polly. Perhaps I would not marry a mighty warrior after all. Perhaps I would marry someone working in a post office. Someone who wanted to make sure that words would always find their way to their intended recipient. And that, I reflected, as I drifted back towards slumber on slow, sweet currents, didn't sound too bad at all. What else could a poet wish for? Chapter 2. Epilogue. "No." Cleofer blinked out of his reverie and turned from his scrutiny of the even surface of the pool that had just swallowed up the merry quicksilver whirlwind that was his Fanoa as a young man. Kanju had stepped into the courtyard, holding the promised cold drinks he had gone in to mix, wearing an exquisite tunic, in an elegant pearl gray, a straw hat with a huge rim, and a very stern expression. "Know what?" Cleofer asked, bemused. Kanju gestured at the pool with one of the drinks. "Know whatever courtyard pool-related mad start you have in mind, such as a standardized pool safety measures, or regulations on pool maintenance, or researching the flora and fauna inhabiting courtyard pools in Gorjo City, or I don't know. But you were definitely giving the pool your thinking look, and we agreed to rest today." Cleofer had started to laugh halfway through Kanju's list. Still chuckling, he accepted the drink, made with his favorite spiced rum and fresh fruit. "Are the local pool safety measures not standardized yet?" he mused, pretending to consider it, and grinned when Kanju gave him his most magnificent eye roll. "Very well. I promise to relax, and I will. No new research or reform ideas, just that I was paid an unexpected visit, and got slightly lost in thought." "Oh?" Kanju sipped his drink and settled in a low chair, half in the shade of the upper floors projecting over the courtyard. Cleofer grinned. "Let's just say I have a tale for dinner tonight, and if we're lucky, we might get the other half of it as well." "Intriguing." Seeing that Cleofer was not about to divulge his secret just yet, Kanju resumed relating a piece of gossip from the city, and they spent a pleasant afternoon relaxing in the sun, talking of small things and enjoying their drinks. Cleofer's eyes kept straying to the pool, and from there to the empty stock, where the tiara had just been cut, and then to the tower room. Through the open windows drifted snatches of hummed melodies and handfuls of notes plucked on a harp as Fitzroy searched for the tune of his new song. Eventually, Kanju heaved a deep sigh. "What is it?" Nothing, Cleofer murmured reflexively. And then, before he could stop to examine the words in more detail, before he could think too closely of how that young man on a quest to glimpse his future spouse had, one day, 1,000 years later, looked at Cleofer and seen in him the other half of his shell. Do you suppose Fitzroy would like to get married? The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this Podfix post. And if you enjoyed this Podfic, you're welcome to leave me feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening.